Caledonia in this land called Canada. A result of cultural oppression.
Now, back to some more news items. Manitoba Métis warn of a backlash from government inaction.
Allow me to introduce myself. I am Volcano Woman. I am brown. I am pissed off and ripped off.
Native Solidarity News on CKUT 90.3 FM. Our story, Tuesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. I remember the days way back when we had no gang fights, we had
no crack pipes, and brothers got along in the families. And welcome to another edition of Native Solidarity News here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Urkar, and I am your host here at Native Solidarity News. And today, we are going to have Amy Gurman and Will Nichols from The Nation magazine, as well as on the bottom of half the hour, we're going to have Ernest Webb from Resolution Pictures, and we're going to be discussing The Last Explorer, which is an historical docudrama about the Cree guide's adventure of glory, death, lost diaries, and forbidden love over 100 years. But first, we're going to take a short musical break, and going to come back with Amy Gurman and Will Nichols. You're listening to Native Solidarity News here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Still need the same God, family, heritage, traditional flame still burns today with a new understanding. 21st century, nations expanding. When our languages get taught, we win. Cause the children can speak to the elders again. We can't change time, but it tries to change us. If we fight, maybe we'll still remain us. Some people tried and failed to drain us, eliminated things needed to sustain us. But here we stand, and the time is now. The curtains raise, and it's time to bow. Sing with the drum or either give me a rhyme. We ain't late, we're just on Indian time. Sometimes you must look below the surface. Know your purpose, though your soul is nervous. The clock can't hold us back, though we're moving. We're God-given opportunities for improving. Time's on our side if we work together. And care for our people, heal the hurt forever.
But I saw glory in their faces, so I served them.
My heart wins.
Oh yes, I know I'm late. Oh yes, I know I am late. Oh yes, I know I am late. The way things are today. The way things are today.
And welcome back to another edition of Native Solidarity News. And that is Honey Dawn Karima. I hope that I pronounced that. And that's Indian time. And that is, she's Cherokee. And she's from North Carolina. And I found her on MySpace. And I just sent her a message and said, yeah, I really like your music. I want a CD. And she emailed me a few tracks and just was like, hey, honey, if you're listening... thanks for the music, and I'm going to be playing some more of that later on in this hour. So I have Will Nichols, Amy German, not German, Amy German, and I have Ernest Webb, and they're all part of the Great Creek Community Magazine called The Nation. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Quay, quay.
Hey.
Hey.
So let's talk about The Nation. How did this begin?
Well, about 15 years ago, we got some information, and you see, during those times, I guess you could say the leadership, like a lot of politicians out there, didn't really pass around that information to the people. Mm-hmm. So we got $1,000, and we started a magazine and just said, let's see how far we can go, how long we can go. We didn't take any salaries for 10 months or anything, didn't have any grants to start up. It was just no business plan, nothing. It was get the information out to the people because they needed it.
It started in our bedroom, actually.
that's Ernie's bedroom, not mine.
Yeah, they weren't sharing.
We weren't sharing bedrooms at that point in time.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. No.
I just don't know how your wife would have felt about it.
Wow, I knew the minute you guys came through the door that we were going to have a good time. So, The Nation, you cover, I've been picking up The Nation for years now, and I notice you cover a vast array of topics when it comes, definitely when it affects the Cree community, because it's predominantly a Cree magazine.
Yes.
But could you tell us about some of the subjects that you talk about?
Some of the subjects, as you said, there's a great many. We've covered everything from Aboriginal politics to forestry to mining to infrastructure, dams. Well, especially dams. They're very important to the Crees. Especially damming the dams, stopping them. And then we've covered entertainment. Everything from books to...
I think one of the... more popular parts is the classifieds. People, you know, they're sort of nosy and then they go straight to the classified sometimes just to see what's going on. But one of the things that we've always kept close to our hearts was that it's also an outlet for people, you know, besides us, you know, giving information to the people, it's also there for the people to express themselves. You know, lots of people send in poetry and, you know, writings, you know, about how they're feeling and what they want to express. So I think that's one of the things that we've accomplished.
Well,
definitely. And, you know, it's kind of funny what he said is very true because after our paper came out a number of years later, the Grand Council of the Crees came out with EU Nation. And their motto underneath it was the voice of the Cree people.
Okay.
And I felt that, well, okay, you might call yourself the voice of the Cree people, but our paper was giving a voice to the Cree people. And it did change a lot of the way politics was done within the communities.
Yeah. Well, the Cree community, especially the Cree community up north, is... when it comes to infrastructure, when it comes to just community, it's a lot stronger than a lot of other First Nations communities across Canada. There's a sustainable infrastructure up there now. Unlike a lot of other communities, it's you can see the poverty in so many other communities, including many other Cree communities. But up north, what's the difference up north?
The difference is that since we were so far up north, we got to keep our independence a lot longer in terms of we had a land base where people were going out, they were trapping, they were hunting, they were living traditional lifestyles because, you know, in my generation, from when I was young, I can still remember when there was no road into my community, mm-hmm. there was no electricity, there was no running water. We had outhouses. If you wanted to get hold of someone, you didn't pick up a phone or your cell phone. You had to walk over or send one of the kids running over. You know, so we've gone from all that mm-hmm. to now within my lifetime to like where we have high-speed internet and whatnot. So
plumbing, you know, and yeah. good housing.
Mm-hmm. Good housing and that. But there's been a lot of work done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a... you know, and there's two sides to the coin, you know, like if you look at the infrastructure, you know, yes, there is education, there is health, there is, you know, all sorts of support for people that's there, but also the underneath people are also suffering, mm-hmm. you know, the young, especially the younger generation, mm-hmm. you know, especially with the coming of the dams, you know, 25, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, so there is a lot of pain that's still out there and that people seem to be just starting to deal with. Mm-hmm. You know, like a lot of my friends, they've gone through the, you know, the whole phase of alcohol, drugs, violence and all that. And a lot of them are now just starting to, you know, take stock of their lives and start the healing journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the suicide rates are comparable to other First Nations groups around Canada.
Yeah, I noticed that this suicide is still a very, very, very big problem in a lot of First Nations communities, probably because a lot of alcohol, a lot of detachment from from the culture.
It's also you don't have control over your lives as much as was in the past. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the pure fact is since... In the 60s, they had the Buffalo Jump program, which was designed to create conditions upon reserves that were so bad that natives would move away and become assimilated into the main population. Mm-hmm. Well, that right there tells you that you don't have an economy, you don't have a say. Mm-hmm. And the high unemployments, anytime you get into the double digits, you will always have social unrest and you will always have problems. Mm-hmm. And there are very few First Nations communities within Canada that have single-digit unemployment statistics.
Right.
So, you know, so you're going to have it across the board.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, when you have the unemployment, you have that social problems, that's when you get all the alcohol and everything else.
Right.
You know, we need to build stable economies, mm-hmm. something that's going to be around, not the stuff like's happening now where you get 4 years with Hydro-Québec building... you know, an extension to their dam, diverting a river, mm-hmm. or whatever, because that's not permanent employment.
Yeah,
that's just you know, a drop in the bucket. Everyone has like money; they all feel good for a while. Mm-hmm. What happens when all those big salaries disappear? What happens when that? You know, you're gonna have another crash. Mm-hmm. You're gonna have another problem.
Well, as you know, the federal budget came down a couple weeks ago, and. Right now, what we're dealing with is what's in it for the First Nations. Now, they've got a great deal of issues going on. Now, I'm just going to point out a few of the things. There's $12 billion for infrastructure, and the First Nations infrastructure investments will support the construction, renewal of schools, improve access to safe drinking water, and build healthcare and policy policing infrastructure in Aboriginal communities. Okay. How much of this do you think is real? You know, it's like we're gonna let Amy.
I'm gonna pass this over to Amy because I've had Amy actually working the last issue totally on these questions.
Yeah,
because I'm still dreaming about it.
Just how much of this is real? Is this going to be an issue that we're still gonna be talking
call.
About?
You see, because. I don't know. Last week, I interviewed Jean Crowder about this from the NDP. She's the INAC critic. And I also interviewed mm-hmm. Beverly Jacobs from NWAC. And then I interviewed Ellen Gabriel from Native Women's Incorporated. And then to get some balance, I talked to Patrick Brazo. Anyway, what was interesting was that, you know, all three women that I'd interviewed said the same thing, which is that you know, it's wonderful to announce this money, but we don't know how it's going to get there, because sure, they said, you know, they're going to roll out $1.4 billion for Aboriginals, and they talked about all these infrastructure programs, but at no point, you know, with the infrastructure programs for reserves, did they say how it would happen. Like, for example, does a band council have to come up with matching funds to have one of these projects, you know, happen in their communities? Do we know about this? No, you know. They talked a lot about how these infrastructure programs as well are going to be creating jobs, which is fine and great and all, but you know, you look at how heavily Canada's been criticized now by the UN, you know, particularly for its treatment of missing and marginalized women, you know, and they consulted with all of the Aboriginal leaders in Canada right before making this budget announcement to see, you know, what could be done for each group in terms of skills and training, what could be done, you know. And women weren't concerned whatsoever in here, which is very problematic, you know. I mean, sure, you want to create lots of construction jobs and that kind of thing, which is fine, but, you know, Ellen Gabriel's criticism was that, well, it's very sexualized work, you know. It's providing a lot of work in one industry sector, you know, that is going to go to a lot of men and might not necessarily reach a lot of single mothers, you know, who are the ones that are vulnerable. Right. Mind you, Brazo jumped in said, oh, well, you know, those women, hey, they can get jobs in architecture. I know a lot of women, you know, marginalized women who, or something to that effect, you know, where he talked about how marginalized Aboriginal women in Canada could take on these, like, architectural jobs. I don't know. It didn't make much sense.
He even mentioned, I think, homeless.
Oh, no, he said that women. Well, they could benefit from the Canada Skills and Training Programs because, you know, everybody without an address can access that. I mean, yeah, I'm just misguided.
Well, it's... Well, from what I've heard about Senator Patrick Brazeau, he really, really needs to learn to keep his mouth shut, because
or tell the truth,
you know.
Or you know, how about, you know? Oh, I'm not going to say that on the air.
No, he is telling the truth, but his version of the truth is perhaps not everyone else's version of the truth.
Well, Brazeau,
his version of the truth seems to be whatever Harper says.
Well, that's very true.
Harper does keep a very tight ship. You know, he monitors. He's one of the biggest control freaks in politics right now. He's like, you have to watch this, you have to watch that. You can't say anything. You know, it's like, but when MPs do screw up, you know, he doesn't chastise them, even though, you know, it's like you have to just take a look at Pierre Poilievre when he made that comment on the day of the apology and said, we're giving too much money to Native people. And it's like, what? I was like, when I heard these, because I listened to the interview, and he says, we've dumped $10 billion into First Nations communities. I'm like, $10 billion? When did that happen? I didn't get the memo. You know, it's like, what's going on with that, you know? But yet, Poilievre still has his job. People like Brazeau still has his job. And as my personal opinion, I don't think Brazeau should have either job from the way he was appointed, which goes against what Harper was saying in the first place, was like, I want elected senates. And
well,
I think all these politicians and actually the top administrators, they should be forced to spend at least 2 weeks to a month on a Native reserve living in the poorest conditions.
Barry Lake
And, you know, then we might see some actual real changes and some innovative changes to the way money is spent and the way it is distributed and how it will affect a community.
Right.
You know,
well, yeah.
Because right now it's like, oh, they're getting too much money.
Yeah.
Well, they might only see one portion of it where you see Patrick Brazeau at CAP, for instance, getting $130,000 to represent off-reserve natives when no off-reserve natives have asked them to represent them. Or if they have, it's been very, very few, and most of them work for CAP.
Well, I mean, he did such a good job there that, you know, once again, you know, we have our Aboriginal Friendship Centers who were also excluded in this budget and
have not received
any new funding since 1998. I mean, in terms of employees, they're working on a pay scale from 1976.
Yeah.
And, you know, these organizations, you know, are funded.
They're on the front lines. The front lines in every urban center in Canada. You know, they take care of the homeless situation. They provide information on diabetes and health concerns. And yet their funding continuously gets cut.
Well, when I first came to Montreal, the Friendship Center was one of the first places I used to go to. I didn't have that much money while I was waiting for funding to come through for going to school and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I was walking to the Friendship Center, and I was like helping to make soup and get a meal that way. Mm. You know, and I wasn't the only one. There was tons of us.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people coming into these areas, the Friendship Center is a place where they can go, they can get assistance, they can get training, they can get all sorts of things. And, you know, if all this government talk about, like, helping, you know, First Nations people off reserves is true, well, we should be funding the Friendship Centers a hell of a lot more than we are.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just not happening. And instead, throwing money at places like CAP is not going to do it.
No.
You know.
Well, that's the thing. The government thinks that you throw money in a situation, it's just going to go away. That's not how it works. If you're going to take Native suicide, for instance, if you want to really focus on bringing down the numbers of Native suicide, then you have to build an infrastructure to deal with the situation. You got to bring in the right people. You got to bring in someone who's intelligent, who's been to university, who knows how to deal and talk with youth about suicide. You know, you have to be able to deal with it. And so you have to delegate the money properly and build the infrastructure from the ground up so that it's properly, it has a good solid base. But my mother used to take me when I was a kid, used to take me to the Native Friendship Center of Montreal all the time, especially the one when it was just across the street from the hospital on Côte
des
Neiges.
Yeah, I remember that one.
I was part of the Native Theater program when I was a kid, and I loved it. It was great because my mother was a Duplessis orphan and was born off reserve. I never really had the connection. I was born severed with a severed connection to my people, so I never really got to know anybody. So when I got to the Native Friendship Center, I was like, hey, there are people just like me here, and this is so awesome. But when I found out that the Native Friendship Center got its services cut again, you know, it's like, what more is this government going to do? You know, it's like they won't sign the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which is essentially saying it's okay. We don't believe that you should have equal rights, because that's essentially what they're saying, isn't it?
Well, they don't.
Yeah, we've apologized, however.
Exactly. You kind of love that apology. It was like 11 and a half minutes long, and I'm a news hound and I watch news all over the place. I watched the apology of Paul Rudd and the Australian Prime Minister when apologizing for the Stolen Generations. And he said, okay, we're sorry about this. And he shared some stories. He said, now this is what we're going to do about it. You know, it's like, what are politicians supposed to do?
Yeah.
You know, it's like Barack Obama. And he said, I'm going to close Guantanamo Bay. The day after he becomes president, he closes Guantanamo Bay within a year. And he says, okay, stop everything. You know, essentially, you know, he does what... Why can't we just, like, have an exchange program for politicians, you know? I'm serious. I have an exchange policy. It's like...
I want that one.
We put them in a room, you know. We have the glass and all that. And we just... The shortest to the tallest, you know. It's like, well, we'll take the short, pudgy one, you know. I liked his policies last year, you know. We should be able to bid on good politicians, you know.
Well, yeah. Or maybe, you know, missionaries could be in charge of them in some third world country. That's another idea.
Exactly, yeah. But that's the thing. It's like when the Canadian government came out against signing the UN Declaration, Ernest, how did that make you feel?
Well, actually, ever since we've been in, because myself, like, when we started the nation, I was more involved in those things, but then when we started doing the films and documentaries with my wife Catherine, those things have sort of fallen to the background for me. So I think Will or Amy would be the best ones to.
As Amy perks up, oh, do I get to talk again?
I had lots of coffee. Well, it's all about land, isn't it? You know.
Well, the surprising thing is there's a lot of rumors that basically the new president of the United States will be looking to sign the declaration.
Really?
Yep. This is just rumors so far, but
well, that would be totally.
If that happens, then I think we've got to do something about getting Harper to sign on. But getting Harper to sign on, like when he did his apology, I hate to say this, but I felt like I was watching some mother bring her kid up and going, you know, okay, you punched this kid. Now apologize to him, you know?
Yeah,
you got that
like
same
that.
Level of sincerity, you know? It's like...
Well, so... when that apology happened, it was just like, wow. You know, it's like you talked about it and you're just like, and how some people were hurt and how some people did this. Yeah. He completely minimized the impact of the residential schools, which... I have to say, my personal opinion, and this has been backed up by Roland Christron, Dr. Roland Christron from the Ojibwe Nation. He talked about how this was a direct act of genocide. And regardless of what Harper says about how some died, tens of thousands of children died in those schools mm-hmm. from tuberculosis and from other ailments. But what do you... It's funny. Barack Obama gets elected in the United States, and all of a sudden Canada is like right in the microscope going, okay, can you match that?
Yeah.
No, I think it's positive. Oh, no, go ahead. Sorry. Well, no, I think it's really positive because, I mean, Canada's had such a pristine reputation in the eyes of the rest of the world, and in certain respects we do, but, you know, we do so much for foreign policy, we do so much for other nations, and yet... We do this and treat our First Nations people worse than, you know, imaginable. I mean, there are reserves across Canada. There's reserves that you can drive a few hours to from here that where it really is developing world conditions. There are plywood homes covered in mold. You know, there's places where we have third-party management systems from INAC where, oh, yeah, the people don't want to do what we're telling them to. Okay, let's cut off the water. Let's cut off the electricity. And it's insane.
They cut off all access to funding. And the only times things get out is when the third-party manager says, yes, I agree with you, Chief. You know, we do need to do something about the sewage system. Or we do need to do something about this.
Well, similar happened.
And I'm sorry, that's back to like becoming wards of the state again.
Yeah.
And there's no damn way I want that for anybody. And I don't think any Native groups want that for themselves.
Yeah.
And the things that they put on it, though, is if you have a 10% deficit, you're going to be put under third-party management of some sort.
Right.
You know, meanwhile... Toronto can go 25-35%, you know, what is it? Non-native municipalities somehow learn how to abuse money more and are used to making those type of loans and deficits, yet natives still haven't caught up.
Well, that's the thing. You know,
it's an inequality.
Definitely.
Disturbing.
Well, that's the thing. It's like I've always found it. It's like the government does just enough to keep us alive. It's like being on life support and just being on life support for 100 years and just like, well, we have the ability to recreate you. We have the ability to revitalize you, but we just don't have the will. And it's unfortunate. Our governments don't have the will.
I think for me, from my perspective as well, I think we need to see a real evolution in politics within the communities as well. You know, like it's always been business as usual and status quo. And I think we need to see some changes in our political structure within the communities as well. Exactly. Like I would love to be able to participate in choosing our national chief.
Yeah.
You know, like I've never like, people died for this in, say, South Africa. One person, one vote. Where's mine?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's talk, actually. What's his name? Is it John Bokash who wanted to run now for the FN chief? He says that if he gets in, he is going to turn that over to the people and make it...
I hate to say this. I've heard this before.
Oh, really?
You know, other candidates, you know, earlier days. It's, you know, like... There's always rumors we're going to make it for people. I think even our own Matthew Kuhnkamp had stated something similar to that they'd be looking at making that happen, and somehow that never happened. He was only there for 4 years, but...
only four.
Or was it three in those days? Who knows?
Well, I think we've, when it comes to First Nations and politics in Canada, we've gone past the... the legends of like Elijah Harper back in the days when it really meant, you know, being there meant something. But we need, I find we need to build on that now. We need to build, yeah. We had, Elijah Harper was our base. Now we need to build on that. We need to be, become stronger. Yeah. We need to be able to influence. It's like Chief Dan George was the one who said, it's like, we need to learn to use the tools of the white man so we may speak in the halls of law and government, which I think was referring to education as well. You know, we really need to actively say, okay, we're done. So what we're going to do is we're going to run for public office. We're going to win, and we'll change the policy ourselves. Is that what it's headed to?
I think that's the way we have to go, and the only way we're going to go, how fast we get there, is going to be another thing. Mm-hmm. Learning to use the tools of the white man. Well, the Crees definitely did that in terms of when we fought Hydro-Québec, when they wanted to do the Great Whale Project. Mm-hmm. But we had to go outside the country to do it. We went into the United States.
Yeah.
You know, you look within Canada, look at what happened in Barrier Lake. Peaceful protest. Yeah, sure, they barricaded a road, right? What happens? The riot squad comes in and beats the hell out of a lot of people while they're dispersing them and whatnot.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you go further north, and what happened when Chibougamau cut off access to my community of Mistassini? They would not let through ambulances. They would not let through medical supplies, mm-hmm. water, gas, oil for heating, mm-hmm. food, nothing.
Yeah. Like
where the hell was that rescue squad then?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that riot squad, I should say. It should have been a rescue squad. Yeah. where was that riot squad then?
Well, it was like 1992.
Like, what is it? Okay, we've got these poor natives on one end. Fine, we'll go in and break a few heads. Ooh, these poor white people on this other hand. We'll leave them alone for this time around.
Exactly.
And how long ago was that?
Basically, that's been within the last few years. Last year, actually.
Well, that was it. So this was last year, but, you know, because it was a white community that was blocking off access. And why did they do it?
Jamisian.
Jamisians.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. In 1990...
By the way, that's not a Cree word for crap or anything. That comes from James Bay.
But in 1990, when the Mohawks stood up against the federal government and provincial governments, you know, it's like and there's still some of that. That's the thing. It's like, it's not only the politicians who have to change their mentalities; it's the people too. Mm. Like on the South Shore, I've been harassed on the South Shore. It's like in the summer times, I love wearing my Mohawk because you know what? It's warmer. But I've had people give me dirty looks. You know, they see me with the warrior symbol on my chest, and they're just like, I'm sorry, what are you doing here? You know, it's like...
I was, at the time, I was working at the CBC. Mm-hmm. My wife, she was my girlfriend at the time. We actually drove down, you know, to Châteauguay and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing she was driving, you know, and we drove by one of the effigies before they burned them, you know, so... So I'm looking out the window and I'm thinking, I say to Catherine, I think we should get out of here.
Well, it wasn't a safe time, but that's the thing. It's like one thing that the Mohawk Nation learned from the 1990 Orca crisis was that if you don't have a weapon, they really can't touch you. Mm. Now, the police, especially in Ontario, the police are so much more brazen when it comes to dealing with First Nations. You got to take a look at Dudley George, for instance, with the tragedy there. And Caledonia, and now Barrier Lake. Mm-hmm. And Barrier Lake, you know, it's like, it was a peaceful protest. The government deliberately removed the chief of the Barrier Lake First Nations, put him in prison because he spoke out and told the truth.
Well, it's a long story in there. You know, there's one faction group that believes that Chief Casey Ratt is the true chief because they left it up to a democratic vote, whereas that community has always kind of voted a different way. It's usually an elders council that selects a chief. Mm-hmm. So, you know, their whole thing is, no, ignore the customary chief, you know, who is presently Benjamin Nottaway. Mm-hmm. You know, he was thrown in jail at their second protest because they had two, one in October and then in November. Mm-hmm. And it was just brutal. I mean, you know, they used torture techniques literally to remove those people from the protest. They put blankets on their heads and squoze their heads in front of children and elderly people. Yeah. They threw gas, tear gas, into a crowd that was, I think it was something like there was like 70 natives and 44 of them were kids.
Yeah.
You know, they arrested kids and said, well, you know, if we find your kids here again, oh, they're coming with us. You know, more protesting for those little ones.
Yeah, they'll be taken under the Youth Protection Act.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like, that's the wrong way to use that act. What is it saying? You cannot say anything. You do not have the right
to speak
for freedom of expression within Canada if you're a native. Yeah. And we'll take your kids. Mm-hmm. You know, if you do. And your kids are not allowed to come and participate in a demonstration.
Yeah, well, the OPP is well known.
Yeah.
The OPP is well known for abusive tactics. You just got to take a look at their crime boss, the commissioner of the OPP. You know, when he threatened Sean Brandt, and was like, I'm going to destroy your life. I'm going to destroy this. I'm going to destroy that. It's like, you're a police officer. You're the boss. You're a peace officer.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to be even opening your mouth. And unfortunately, fortunately for Sean Brandt, you know, all the charges were dropped because, well, the commissioner did not want to come in front of an inquiry and explain himself. But, you know, that's, once again, that's another story. And unfortunately, we are going to take a short musical break. We're going to come back because we're going to talk with Will Nichols, Amy German, and Ernest Webb, and we're going to be talking about his film because he, like he mentioned earlier, he is a filmmaker, and I want to know more about this film. I love the fact that more and more Native people in Canada are moving towards the arts, like either hip hop or filmmaking. So we're going to come back. We're going to listen to DJ Nave. Now this is a guy from the Cherokee Nation, and I really really like this guy. This guy is totally cool, and he's the first musician that I've heard, a Native musician who's done techno. I'm a big fan of techno, so this is DJ Nave, and you're listening to Native Solidarity News here on CKUT 90.3 FM.